10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Live from London, this is the Sunday Morning Breakfast Show with Sobhya Iqbal on Teachers Talk Radio.
Good morning. You're listening to Sobhya's Stellar Sunday. It's Sunday, the 16th of May. I have some brilliant conversations coming your way. Are UK schools really innovative with their use of technology? Why is there still so many issues with edtech in schools? And how can technology really transform education? This and much, much more. It's another thrilling morning. Prepare for takeoff.
London. This is the Sunday Morning Breakfast Show with Sobhya Iqbal on Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live on the Podbean app or desktop player. Just head over to www.podbean.com/lsw/ttradio or search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio.
Have you entered our fabulous competition yet? Do you have something to say about the future of education? Do you have positive ideas about the way things could or should be in the future? You need to create a 10-minute video presentation and send it to teacherstalkradio@gmail.com. You can win £50 and it will be featured at a high-profile education event. Deadline is 22nd of May. Don't delay, do it today. I'm excited to have a fellow IT geek on the show today. It may turn into a rendition of the IT crowd, although I promise not to yell, fire, fire, help me, too often throughout the interview. It's my favourite part of the show, and I love Maurice Moss. On that note, I'd like to introduce my fabulous guest today. Ismail Dhan is a former assistant head from the infamous ESA Academy. He's a national award winner for driving digital fluency in schools for a one-to-one iPad for learning project. He's working on distance learning, blended learning, and edtech solutions with a focus on pedagogy. We're just going to come to him now. Ismail, welcome to the show. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well. Thank you very much for having me on. It's an absolute pleasure. I've got my coffee here, so I've got my caffeine fix. I'm talking about a subject which I'm really passionate about. So I've got a feeling it's going to be a great morning, Sobhya.
Great. Thank you for coming on. Ismail, can you just tell our listeners what your background is and what do you do? And can you explain your journey leading up to now?
Of course, yes, with pleasure. So I've been in education as a mainstream teacher for around 16, 17 years now. And initially started my teacher training on the graduate teacher program back in them days, thrown in at the deep end. My subject specialism was secondary ICT. Although I did have, you know, a bit of a computer science background from university, etc. So I started on that and then, you know, up the ranks, department head, middle leadership on both sides from pastoral and curriculum, then progressed on to sort of more whole school projects, including education technology, involved in, you know, leadership from teaching and learning perspective, school CPD, and also, you know, largely focused around technology as well with integration within a whole school environment. And had the privilege really of moving to a school in 2009, which then employed a principal who was really sort of visionary and took things, and his vision was something I'd never come across before. When we talk about technology, he was probably, you know, he was way ahead of the game and he wanted things completely different and he was a risk taker. And we were one of the first schools in the UK at that time to go down the one-to-one provision route. And we started off with the iPod Touches back in 2009. And I was, you know, thankful to be involved in that program to help set that up and deliver that. And then we sort of evolved along the way and went down the iPad route as well.
That sounds great. So obviously you became a national award winner and obviously yeah. ESA Academy is well known for tech. Yeah. Do you think technology is good or bad for learning?
Well, Ultimately, in my opinion, there's no doubt that technology can enhance the teaching and learning experience. But ultimately, it's down to how it's used. And I think that's, you know, that's what any educational technology expert will tell you. The issue we have, really, I don't think it's the question, you know, it's about whether it's good or bad. There's elements of the technology, providing that it's implemented well, providing that it's got a strategy and a vision behind it, which supports the use of technology within the classroom, and it's encouraged within the classroom instead of leaving teachers to it. It can enhance the teaching and learning experience. But at the same time, I have seen it where it's embedded poorly, without any strategic vision behind it, and it's had an adverse effect. But that's the same with any tool that you're going to use in the classroom. Used poorly, it's not going to do the job.
So when it is used poorly, do you think that classroom technology is actually currently holding students back from what they can actually achieve?
You see, technology can play such a big part within the classroom, and it's down to what technology you're using and how you're using it. So currently, if we have a look at how technology is used, there's a big shift at the moment, understandably, with COVID and everything going on. So there's a lot of distance learning taking place, and a lot of, you know, the key buzzwords that are flying around, asynchronous and synchronous learning examples. And I'll talk you through the journey of my children. And I think that's probably a good place to start as a parent. And, you know, when my children's school initially started using the technology, you know, they weren't familiar with it, but they were thrown at the deep end, just like everybody else. The start of the journey right at the beginning of lockdown was completely hit and miss. The curriculum content was hit and miss. It was more a case of just send something out to the students to keep them busy. There wasn't any thought about content or the size of the files or all the technology aspects behind it. And because at that time it was rushed and it was slightly poorly implemented, we were finding that the children were a little bit disengaged. They were losing a little bit of heart within, you know, even logging in the morning or trying to download the work. So, there is a potential risk that if it's used poorly and not really thought through, then it can have a bit of a negative impact. But you've got to remember, when you're talking about distance learning, we were forced into a position where the children had to use technology. There was no other way around it. So if it was going to be used poorly, then it was going to have a negative impact. But when you're in a school environment, there is the choice there when and where to use it. So you could counter that or, you know, decide on the right times to use it.
And so coming back to the remote learning experience that we had about a year ago, clearly we have a digital divide, and it's only due to COVID the inequality has been highlighted. It's always been there, but it's never been highlighted as much as it was during the pandemic. How do you think the field of education will change now after the pandemic?
You see, I've had the privilege of working, and I'm going to give a big shout out to Oldham Learning and the Oldham Local Authority Borough, because they've taken a real strategic approach in managing the distance learning. They've taken a borough-wide approach. A lot of schools have been left to it, but these guys have decided to take a borough-wide approach. And my involvement there was to work with all the secondary schools, or a majority of the secondary schools. We're talking about 15 to 16 secondary schools, and interviewing the senior leaders and the head teachers to start with. It opened their eyes as to the extent of the digital learning divide. Everybody knew about it, like you say, but that was now a big problem. And they had to rapidly think of ways. And I know that the DfE laptop program was there to support schools, but not all schools were managed to tap into that particular resource. So a lot of the schools, you know, thought very creatively at that time. Mobile devices where students had access to them was used, although I'm not convinced that that's going to, it's useful, but I'm not convinced that, you know, higher order thinking and real in-depth learning can take place on that level. A lot of schools then decided to actually recycle a lot of their computers that they have within school and start distributing them, which I thought was a really good way of trying to combat that particular issue. And it was one last thing. What was really, really an eye-opener was where the schools are located and the catchment area and the pupils they serve. we had some schools where every student had 3 or 4 devices at home, so they had no issues having access to it because they were parents that were working in professional backgrounds and can afford it. But then you had the schools at the opposite end, which I'm used to working in. My experience has been working in a lot of deprived communities where students just don't have the access, full stop. There is no device, or if there is, there's one that's shared between, you know, a number of people within the household, and that caused a particular issue.
And some of the issues you've highlighted, I mean, we had issues as well in terms of laptop provision. I mean, the government sent out all these laptops, but there were a couple of issues with that, weren't there? Firstly, not all schools received the laptops. Mm-hmm. And secondly, when they did receive the laptops, they weren't working. Either their passwords weren't working or some form of software wasn't applicable. And so, you know, that kind of made, you know, put schools into a position where they weren't able to work effectively with those students who did not have any technology at home.
Yeah. And you mentioned that, I mean, the DfE laptop, and it was almost like a smash and grab at some point. You know, speaking to some schools, it was almost, when I was speaking to a lot of leaders and head teachers, it was a case of we were lucky we got in there early and we managed to get this many laptops. And then I'd speak to a second school and said, well, we've hardly had any. And I suppose it was a rushed process. It wasn't really thought through, but we couldn't, because we were hit and we had to make decisions at that time. It's always difficult when you're in a position like that where you have to make such rushed decisions. And I think that's what the issue was. And every school context is so different. What the curriculum requirements are, how they've designed the curriculum, it's difficult to assess what that is and then have technology provided to suit all needs. So I think that was a particular issue.
And we've had some comments come in. One person said that technology is the future and we have to embrace it and use it to our advantage in order to compete in the modern world. And we've got another comment here saying, very interesting, yesterday talking to their American guest, so it's a host, who said that this was barely a problem in US schools.
Completely understand that. I mean, technology is the future. I mean, you know, Generation Z and millennials take up 50% of the, you know, current workforce. Generation Z are coming along, and you know, these guys are the ones that are technology savvy, you know, using social media communication tools, platforms is second nature to them, more so than other, you know, human skills to a certain extent. So unless we sort of engage with that and tap into that, you know, natured skill set that Generation Z have and the future generations, I think, you know, we're kicking ourselves massively in the UK. And just to point out as well, Bloomberg have conducted a research and study on the most innovative economies and most innovative people, and sadly to see that UK isn't listed on there. And you're talking schools like Singapore and a lot of the Scandinavian countries are regarded as some of the most innovative and, you know, creative thinkers out there in the industry, and we really need to catch up.
I'm going to come back to the comment that you made about mobile phones a bit later on and social media, but now that you've spoken about this, can you tell me, why do you think schools are behind other industries when it comes to technology and also other countries?
I think for me, the biggest issue is, if you're serious about, a school can only impact so much within the constraints that it has. When I referred to, you know, when I changed schools in 2009 and I went to East Academy, I was fortunate enough to work with a principal at that time who had a vision, who felt that it was the right vision. He stuck to that vision and everything else was slotted into that vision. So the technology and the vision and the pedagogy was completely and utterly at the forefront of his mind. This is how we should be developing our young people. And technology and innovation and creativity was the centerpiece within the school life. And everything fits around. Whereas nowadays, I think school leaders school leaders are forced to consider so many different stakeholders and so many objectives that the government have set, that technology often comes in later. And there's the issue. I think there needs to be governmental change at the, you know, at the highest of levels first, if we're really to have the ability to open doors and expand and allow leaders to really experiment and take things on board and move along quickly.
And this was one of the questions that I wanted to explore today, that do you think UK schools are innovative in comparison to schools worldwide? And I'm going to give you some examples. So, for example, in the Netherlands, ICT literacy has the same importance as English and maths, whereas in the UK it doesn't, like you've just said, that, you know, ICT and business usually get put at the bottom of the pile after everything else. And that is something that needs to be addressed, I personally feel, in the education system as well. The US in Texas, they have a school that has Wi-Fi hotspots for students that don't have access at home. So clearly they're technologically advanced.
Yeah.
In Germany, they actually did what you did. They had the iPad one-to-one learning taking place, and they've been very successful with that. In Italy, they've started using VR and they're using the Oculus Rift and they've been streaming lessons live. And in Australia, they're also using VR to deliver vocational education so that if they are training for hazardous jobs or dealing with risk, they've got all these things in place to help deliver that learning. It's not like that in the UK.
It's not like that in the UK, largely because how the assessment and the judgment of schools are so rigorous and so strenuous on leaders that their focus is shifted on that. Ofsted, you know, schools are judged on the outcomes and the results, which you know, I'm not suggesting for one moment that we shouldn't be judging schools or we shouldn't be in a position where we can, you know, where we can decide what makes a good school and what's education. But we really need to change and shift the focus. School leadership is becoming a bit like Premier League management. You know, your results aren't there, you're out. You know, it's becoming cutthroat. So what tends to happen in those in places like that, something as creative and as innovative as technology is considered a massive risk. And the only way that that's going to be a successful, you know, successfully embedded within an education system or within a school is if it's been given the enough amount of funding, the continuous professional development, the engagement of all the stakeholders, and significant amount of a medium to long-term plan to help embed it within the curriculum to see the fruitful benefits towards the end. Do leaders have that much time and that much energy and funding available? I think that's where the issue is.
Another thing that I want to ask you related to this, do you feel that senior leadership teams know enough about technology and are they even engaged with the change that needs to take place?
Well, this is the biggest challenge that you face. Even when I was, you know, involved within technology in my role within a school that had a vision around it, what you often find in schools is, technology, it's this person's job. And they tend to, you know, if you're serious about technology and it's as part of your vision, then it's everybody's job. And that's where the issue, you know, that's where the issue lies. And even within senior leadership teams, there's, you know, I've seen schools where the roles and, you know, within senior leadership are so distinct that there's very little room for cross-collaboration. And the most successful schools that I've seen where technology has been integrated, there's a lot of cross-collaboration working amongst the senior leadership team. There are regular, they have regular opportunities to consider their edtech strategy. But that's not just the job of one person. It's got to be looked at from a whole school strategic objective, and that includes all the senior leaders. Do I think that senior leaders really understand technology? I don't think they do. I'm going to be honest with you. There's a lot of schools where they just don't understand how to effectively use it from a pedagogical perspective. You know, the easy stuff, using Word, using, I suppose a lot of more schools and subjects are using technology for a bit more video content creation. But have they really considered how it's enhancing teaching and learning? And that's the ultimate aim.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. I mean, that's been my experience because I've been in computer science and ICT for a very long time as well. And I would say that one of the issues that we have with remote learning, for example, right now, and even beyond this with e-learning, is that as teachers and educators, we haven't really been given training on good instructional design with regards to pedagogy and how to deliver outstanding pedagogy using technology. And I find that really strange.
It's so true.
For example, one of the things that I've been thinking about, and you can agree or disagree here, but with teacher training, I found that I did a secondary ICT PGC as well, and we didn't really cover innovation and change. And I think that's something that really needs to be embraced in teacher training for not just ICT PGC students or whatever route you take, but teaching in general really needs to have a focus on IT skills development right from the beginning.
Absolutely, 100%. I couldn't agree with you more. And that's part of the issue, isn't it? I remember when I did my graduate teacher program, one of the skills tests was how to use spreadsheets and, you know, certain data analysis tools, and it was just sort of glossed over. But ultimately, you've got to consider if we want to see a significant change and we want to be competing with the global leaders out there in terms of innovation, then we need to start from the grassroots. And that's where we're talking about, developing and assessing the younger teachers that are coming into the profession or early teachers into the profession. And that's one of the things that my previous school where I used to work was very successful at in its early inception. We focus heavily. Our teacher development program was so significant that we focused on pedagogy, and we had specific models and a school way of life in terms of how we use technology within the classroom. And these people then came on when they eventually finished the teacher training program, and a lot of them were employed at the school. They became the leaders within the school environment who I used to work with. And these guys were part of my team in helping to address the challenges across the whole school. So they were part of a tech hub, pedagogical tech hub that we had within the school to support everybody else.
And I think that is important. Like you said earlier, it's not just the role of one person. You do need to have a whole team behind you in order 100%. To showcase how to use teaching and learning effectively with the use of technology. And I think one of the complaints always is that we don't really need ICT, because if ICT causes problems, then really teaching and learning is not effective. And we should be thinking about innovation in teaching and learning. However, there are arguments to this, right?
Yeah, there are. I mean, the biggest issue for me is, and I hate to say this, but we're always talking, as we have just done now, we've talked about teaching and learning and ICT, and we've completely separated the two already. And therein lies the problem. We must consider, you need to look at it through it's got to be from a pedagogical lens. And if you look at the models, and there are two that particularly stick out in mind at the moment. So there's the SAMA model, which looks at substitution, augmentation, modification, redefinition. These are the different levels of technology integration within a learning setting. And then you've got something which is known as TPACK, T-P-A-C-K for people that are out there that want to research it. That looks at three fundamental factors within teaching and learning as well. So, and tech integration, unless we start looking at it as a streamlined approach, you're always going to find those particular issues. You're always going to separate the two. And the reason for that is because teachers haven't been exposed to real life examples of how technology can enhance the education process, and also real life examples of how it can accelerate the education and the learning process. And that's where the issue lies. You're always going to get one thing that frustrates me about technology is and people's view on technology is we always focus on where it goes wrong. We never focus on, actually, you know what? Let's just step back a moment. Let's look at life in general How has technology enhanced my life? Well, it has significantly, but we never really talk about that. We always talk about, well, this went wrong and therefore I couldn't do this. Well, if it wasn't there, how would you have done it before? And you know, that's what we really need. That's human nature, I suppose.
Yeah, so it's all about, like, for example, showcasing what's working really, really well, making sure that that's being implemented in schools properly. I have a comment in from a listener who said that their daughter's secondary school gave all students a brand new laptop. That was approximately 1,300 new laptops, and they were very grateful. Why were some schools able to do that and others weren't?
Okay, a really, really good question again. I think you've got to look at the school structure and the setup. So when I was a part of Easter Academy when it first started, number one, we had a principal who had a significant vision. His vision was around technology implementation within education, not just within teaching and learning. It was to improve processes and it was to improve everything. You've got to have a leadership. If you want to see that level of implementation, you've got to have a leadership team that is backing and it's as part of the strategic vision of the school. That's number one. If you don't have a head teacher leadership team that thinks along those lines, then it's going to struggle. You're going to struggle having that. Secondly, the leadership team and the principal had agreed on a set budget every year that this is how much we're going to spend. And it was above and beyond the norms of what normally schools would spend. So the question here lies is, well, where are you going to get that kind of money from? Well, what they did was we cut back on other aspects. So we significantly cut back on what we found was with the use of technology within education, we could significantly cut back on costs of cover because all the resources and everything was already available. You didn't necessarily have to have a specialist teacher within the classroom. Students were trained to be able to work, but we found that independent learning increased significantly. So if the teacher wasn't there, then, you know, the students already knew where to go, how to access, etc. And therefore, because there was a lot of cost cutting in other areas, the use of paper, can you imagine the paper bill within schools? Huge.
Yeah.
The school, and I remember this, there was an uproar. There was so much, you know, change resistance, but the school decided to completely scale back the number of photocopiers and printers within the school. Completely. I'm talking, it was a radical shift.
Something that we do need to discuss as schools, because, you know, there are schools across the world going and using these systems where we are creating a paperless society.
Yeah.
And it is effective. And, you know, it does save a lot of money as well.
Yeah, it saves. I would never advocate going down the route of, you know, we don't need to use the pen and paper anymore. You know, that is still a very important skill set, especially for a lot of schools that are in challenging demographics where, unfortunately, a lot of these skills haven't been developed in young people and they don't necessarily have those skill sets. And there are schools that are out there like that, including the ones that I've worked at. So I would never advocate that we need to move away from that. But what I would strongly suggest is, do we really need to be printing out and having a million and one worksheets, etc., going, you know, continuing on that particular trend? You can work without it. You can work with, there's definitely ways around it. And if you're in a school which has given a provision, a one-to-one provision, and providing that it's managed well within the school setting and the actual provision is managed well, then you're in a position, you're already onto a winner. The only thing to bear in mind is, you do have different needs within a school environment. You've got children with, you know, learning challenges that have got specific learning needs. Technology is not the solution for everyone. It will help enhance, but there are times where you will need to revert back to a little bit more traditional practices to support and accelerate the learning to help some students access the technology as well, because there's a lot, technology can be a little bit overwhelming at times.
Okay, we're going to come back to that in a minute. I've had Tim message in saying, trying to continue the use of tech skills gained by himself and students during lockdown has been very much a solo effort for him.
Yeah.
It's been talked about making it a whole school thing, but if it's not done now, the momentum will be lost. And Graham's messaged in saying that our school has just invested in entirely new computers, whiteboards and visualizers for all classrooms, which is fantastic, but the computing suite and laptops are not updated, so there's lots of conflicts across the network. And when we're investing this much money but we're still having random problems in each classroom, that is an issue for teachers and it does put them off.
100%. And the biggest resistance that I've found, I mean, my role When I was working at my previous school, you know, as a whole school, across whole school IT, was working with teachers and targeting the support, my support network, towards teachers that needed the help. And I would never blame teachers are the best, teachers are the most innovative and creative people who can think on the spot and have so much going on in their heads at a single amount of time that they need all the help that they can get. And I'm a massive advocate, you know, they need to, and the reason for the resistance or the change resistance towards technology is largely because of exactly what you've said. Number one, you've got to get your infrastructure. If you're serious about investing in technology and having a technology-fronted education system, you must invest in your systems and processes and procedures and have, you know, have somebody who really understands technology. That's part of the issue.
And that's what I want to ask you about infrastructure. Do you think that schools have the capability and infrastructure for effective use of technology? Because sometimes that's where the problem lies as well.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it ultimately comes down to budget restraints, isn't it? Let's be absolutely honest. And you've got to, it's down to how the school's finances are managed, and you know, and it's down to the vision. And if you've got a principal who's willing to set aside a set budget, I'm going to spend this much, which is slightly above the norm, on technology every single year, to consider not just the purchase of technology, but the ongoing costs associated with technology and the continuous professional development of staff. Those are massive. And often those are the ones, those are the things that are forgotten.
And you were talking about staff development before, and you were saying that sometimes it's really hard to change the way that teachers perceive technology and want to use technology. And I was reading a report, and it said that the precondition of innovative and enthusiastic teachers may not be in place. So that is an issue that we have, that despite teachers wanting to, most of them, there are still people who are not willing to adapt with the use of technology being used more frequently in classrooms.
Yeah, I think that also comes down to a little bit of a fear factor as well. There's, you know, and I've certainly witnessed this, that there are teachers and educators out there that are genuinely concerned that their jobs are on the line. And, you know, with all these new educational apps and technologies and strategies, and we're talking about artificial intelligence, and there's nothing in my mind to suggest that anything can replace a teacher in the classroom. The teacher is an expert. You know, the skill sets that a teacher possesses, I don't think technology can ever replace that.
And the only we're not going to be replaced by machines then.
well, this is it. You know, it's not going to happen, honestly. And I would hate to see an environment where my children or my children's children are just completely, you know, immersed in education, which is completely technologically driven. Technology works well only when the person using it understands how and when to use it well. And we've got to focus on that. And how do we open the minds of the people that are resistant and understandably resistant? Is they need to be able to network with the people that are positive, change agents within the school. But let's take these people outside of school and show them avenues and places where it has been used well. And we focused a lot on that massively within our previous school.
So do you think the quality of online learning can stack up against in-person teaching then?
For me, it's always about enhancement of the process. So, you know, a human being in class teaching has its benefits. You know, the interaction, the human elements of it, a teacher and other students being able to see facial expressions. You're not going to get that with technology as much or to such an extent. There are so many social and emotional factors that technology is not really going to pick up at that particular, it's so real time. So there's always that benefit. But what you've got to remember is technology opens other avenues and other doors that you wouldn't necessarily be able to do before. So for example, the personalization aspect of it, having a device in my hand, my children having a device at home where he can or she can look at aspects of learning in their own time. Well, you're not going to be able to do that within the classroom environment. So this has enhanced it straight away already. The fact that they can revisit the learning topics and principles, providing the curriculum's been, you know, available for them to access online and revisit topics. Well, you're not necessarily going to be able to go back to that classroom and have that lesson again. So, you know, it's about the enhancement and the other avenues, the other opportunities that it provides. So it's got to work hand in hand. I don't think there's any way around it now. you know, we've got to seriously consider the 24/7 learning provision.
So what does a good ed tech strategy look like in schools?
Okay, for me, you've got, when you the ed tech strategy, I'm a little bit against, and I don't mean against having ed tech, but what I'm talking about is ed tech strategies tend to be a document or a piece of paper or something which is set aside from everything else. The best ed tech strategies that I've seen is where the whole school curriculum and plan and the school improvement plan or the school strategy and vision is, the ed tech has been weaved into that. Okay, so I'm going to talk about, the first thing is, the leaders need to consider the end point, and this is the biggest issue. Step one, how do we want technology to look and work in our school? You've got schools that are going the whole hog. We want it as the centerpiece. I want, you know, innovative teaching and learning. I want students to have access to technology at all times. I want 24/7 access learning. I want it as a one-to-one provision. I want to walk into a classroom and really visualize it, where students are using technology freely and accessing it, and, you know, being able to have access, ready access to immediate information. Then you've got the halfway house. I want it to be used if and when necessary. I want it within school. And then you've got those that are just embarking on the journey. So you really need to identify where you are or where you want to be as a school in terms of how technology is going to look and feel within your school environment, and then take steps back to on how you can achieve that. And the best strategies are the ones where leaders and have actually gone out, they've researched it, they've seen and visited schools where technology is being used well. They're involved in discussions like this, and they're talking to key stakeholders, and they understand how it's going to be implemented. And then secondly, the best ed tech strategies are, you know, school improvement strategies, where continuous professional development is at the heart of it. Myself, even though I've been, you know, significantly involved in technology, I'm out of the loop. And I'm always going to be. You've got to be comfortable with that. The fact that technology moves at such a rapid pace that you've got to, you know, continuous professional development has got to be at the forefront of your strategy. And that's so important, as well as having, you know, a significant look at your infrastructure. If your infrastructure isn't right, then, it's, you know, you're going to have so many problems that it's just going to put teachers off. Let's focus on that as well. It's really important. And you've got to have a real collaboration amongst whoever your teaching and learning lead is, so your curriculum leads, and also, you know, whoever your tech lead is. And they've both got their roles, and working together is so important in making sure that the delivery is streamlined and technology is used pedagogically for the right reasons.
Okay, so in terms of procurement, why do schools make such bad decisions when it comes to procurement? And why do edtech investments have the worst return on investment in schools?
It's a really, really good question, this, Sobi. And what is the return on investment? I think we need to look at that first of all. What are we expecting to see as an outcome from the use of technology? I don't know if you remember our previous meeting and podcast that we were a part of, EdTech Summit, we all agreed that we've not really considered what sort of impacts we're looking at. And technology can potentially have a range of different impacts within an educational setting. So we need to look at how it's being measured. The most obvious measure in terms of return on investment is outcomes, okay? Because that's what schools are judged on to a certain extent. There are a lot of edtech providers and solutions out there which claim, for example, and GCSE Pod, I refer to this quite often, and they're a fantastic resource and everything, but they do push the boat out, because if you look on the website or Google search, you'll find that it says using GCSE Pod for this many hours and this many times a week will enhance your GCSE results by 1.5. There's a lot of variables at play there, you know. Engagement, understanding, access to technology, you know, there's so much. And I think we really need to consider what we mean by impact. Largely what I found is the schools that are, you know, buying technology, it's just generally left to somebody who may not have the time or the energy to really consider the impacts of a whole school. And it's not really been considered from a strategic senior leadership perspective.
I guess I think one of the things that obviously I've been thinking about, and other people who are experts in the field have been talking about, is that sometimes there's very little systemic testing of what works in practice. And because of that, obviously people are very unsure of whether to, like you said earlier, take a risk in it or not. There was a EdTech Innovation Fund that was released by Nesta and the DfE. It was a joint project, and they basically were awarding £100,000 in 2019 to improve and use digital technologies in schools. And they looked at four different areas. They looked at formative assessment, yeah. They looked at essay marking, parental engagement, and timetabling. And the whole point of it was to reduce workload and improve pupil outcomes. Yeah. But my take on this is that there's a lot of money being invested in tech, but it's not being filtered down into schools or being used correctly the way that schools should be using it. And how do we avoid those issues? Because there's a lot of money being wasted otherwise, isn't it?
Yeah. The only way that we're going to be able to, we're in a position to be able to see, you talk about the research aspects of it, but we need to engage more schools within that research. So a lot of the funding has to be funneled back into the schools instead of just, there's a lot of researchers out there that do the research and get, you know, the funding's around all the research. But there's got to be a lot more investment within schools and providing a lot of that funding within schools to have some real-time research that's taking place. The school context is so different. Every school is so different. The needs of the students are so different that I'm not skeptical. I understand the research and you know the reasons behind the research. But what works in one school isn't necessarily going to work in other environments. So schools need that breathing space and funding to be able to research things themselves. And I think more often than not, when there is a little bit of money to invest in technology, It's almost what you go to an EdTech show and whatever blings the most and wherever there's the most people, people jump on the bandwagon. And it happens too often, where people are jumping onto a bandwagon without seriously considering it.
Yes, I agree. And one of the problems also associated with that is obviously technology fails, and there is a lack of evidence of what works, because if schools are independently, we don't have that we don't have that information. And it's a question that a lot of educators ask: how can we prove that it's working? And that's probably the reason why that is not working as well as it could be.
I think there's got to be a unanimous agreement in terms of what you're looking at in terms of impact. If you are seriously thinking, if you're looking at technology as an impact on, straight GCSE outcomes, then I think you're going to always struggle to prove that. Because even when you're talking about teaching and learning, these are softer side of things. You know, they're not necessarily, you can't put numbers or figures to it. But it's all it's about experiences. It's about enhance or speeding up a particular process. And you talk about formative assessment or assessment, but even low stakes quizzes. Ultimately, for me, the way I see it and what I would expect technology to do within a classroom learning environment is, number one, enhance the experience of the students and the teacher. So, immediately when you start talking about video content, you're talking about 24/7 access to learning. Well, that is an enhancement. You can't get around that. You're talking about assessment. We want to improve the teacher's work-life balance and improve the assessment. Well, instead of having so many rigorous testings every so often, why don't you have a school-wide strategy where you're going to do it as a online assessment tool which calculates the outcomes immediately? You use that, immediately reduce the teacher's workload. A lot of pen and paper marking takes place, teachers carrying books on. Well, when I was at my previous school, students were uploading the work onto a specific platform. They were thought about a process of uploading work onto that platform, and a teacher could access it, at the click of a button and give feedback using voice feedback. So you're not sat there with a pen and paper. And the impact of that, can you imagine a child opening up their work and there's a speech bubble there and they press play and you've got a teacher who's singing and dancing about the work, and the tone of voice and the impact that that can have on that child is significantly different and improved compared to a tick or a little comment.
And yeah, and Yeah, obviously. And a lot of teachers want that. They want to be able to use technology effectively to reduce workload because we are up against it all the time. So my question is that with technology, we're always told that it's going to make our lives easier, but it doesn't seem to be. So is that because of the fact that, you know, why is that? Is that due to our workload or the way that the education system is? Technology doesn't seem to be making things easier for us right now.
I think UK teachers are some of the most creative and innovative people that I've ever met. You know, within such restricted boundaries, the way they have to think about things and implement ideas, and the way they have to sort of really flex what their skill sets and the skill set that they have and really expand on them to be able to achieve what they need to achieve. The superheroes, I've got to be honest with you, but there's only so much that they can do. I'm going to come back to that point again. When we look at technology, we always tend to look at the aspects that don't work for us. And the teacher's experience within the classroom, they've got an hour to get through so much and there's so much juggling going on that they don't have the necessary time or the energy to deal with certain technological issues. So the minute something goes wrong, from my experience, you know, it's the teachers, they're not necessarily going to have the skill sets to be able to go around and deal with certain tech issues. And that's where the infrastructure comes in. You must spend, you must look at your infrastructure to make sure that it's suitable to allow that level of provision.
And so then moving on then, I'm just going to give you an example. When I did a bit of supply teaching many years ago, and I was doing supply teaching in primary schools, and I found that there was a lack of ICT and computing being delivered in primary schools. Why do they not deliver it in primary schools properly?
I think part of the reason you've got to look at is when you look at other countries, you know, a digital strategy, a digital literacy is high up there on the agenda. And it's not necessarily the case. The primary schools have got certain factors that and certain things that they're being measured against, and therefore they're going to concentrate on those aspects. Skill set comes into it as well. Primary schools, what I found is the teachers are so multidisciplined that they have to work across a breadth of subject areas. Technology is one of them which requires continuous improvement, continuous research, continuous self-development. Are they necessarily going to have the time to be able to do that as well as manage all the other disciplines? And that's why technology aspects within the primary education, within a school setting, tends to be, you know, a 3-week module where they're going to be doing a little bit of Scratch or a little bit of this. But, you know, it hasn't really been expanded upon. So their experience is less.
But surely if we're going down the government's guideline of computer science in all schools and making sure that we're world class and we have a good, you know, amount of programmers in the country, surely that goes against it. Because if we're not teaching them from primary school level, then, you know, how are we going to meet those targets of getting programming back into, you know, the UK industry?
Yeah, I think, again, it's got to be looked at from... It's got to be something that is high on the agenda. I mean, we're talking about two strands of technology here. We're talking about digital literacy, that's one, and we're also talking about expertise within the computing side of things. And I think sometimes we can get a little bit mixed up here. If you're specifically talking about the computer science side of things and having a generation of programmers, it's a very niche area. You've got to really be into it. Primary schools, I think the way forward for me is to employ teachers that have that specific subject specialism and who can really drive that within the school and the curriculum environment. And part of the issue with that is our tech graduates and people that are very, you know, into computer science and stuff, would they choose to work in education or would they choose to work in industry? And the chances are a lot of them are going to move into the industry side of things. So we're lacking that skill set within the education side. Does that mean we pay them a little bit more? My personal opinion, teachers should get paid more anyway.
Well, I think this is an issue that the government needs to consider, because obviously at that time when I think it was... I'm not sure. I have to, if anyone knows, but I think it was Andreas Schleicher, the director of OECD, Directorate for Education and Skills. At that time, when we did have a lack of computer science within the curriculum, he was surprised that the UK schools didn't have computer science on there. And that's when Gov made a decision, if I remember correctly, to change the curriculum. Now, you know, people need to be aware that computer science is completely different to ICT, like you've just said, and digital technology and delivering and using digital technologies. And do you feel that that was the wrong decision or was it the right decision? Should we have carried on teaching ICT and computer science or should we have just stuck to computer science like we are now?
Okay. For me, computer science is, without a shadow of a doubt, it's the way forward in terms of the economy, and there's a real shortage and a gap of programmers, gamers. A lot of this is done abroad, and we really need to plug that gap because it's a massively growing industry. It's a multi-billion dollar industry, app development, etc. And we're UK has a shortage in that area. So 100% introducing the computer science curriculum, I think it's an absolute positive thing, but we've missed a massive, getting rid of the IT curriculum, I think was a massive mistake, because the IT curriculum develops a skill set which is applicable in any environment of our workplace. We're now going to be in a position, and we'll probably find it within teachers as well, where we're going to have teachers that have had very limited experience of using technology in terms of even simple things like using the spreadsheets to enhance, you know, for data analysis, or using, you know, certain aspects of technology to enhance what they're doing. And these are really important skill sets. People have dismissed it as, oh, these are just secretarial skills. Well, no, I'm sorry, but these are foundational skills that are required just as much as English, maths, and, you know, within any job environment, you need to be a competent user of basic technology. And unfortunately, that has been completely missed, and we're going to suffer the consequences of it. And there's already talks of it coming back. In fact, there are some curriculum, you know, some examples that are offering, you know, vocational courses around that.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with you. I do think that it was the wrong decision to move, you know, just to computer science, because, you know, those skills are still needed, especially in industry as well. Another question I wanted to ask you. There was obviously this big constant debate about having mobile phones in the classroom. Now, we're tech. So can you just explain to me what are your thoughts on having mobile phones in the classroom from a technology point of view?
You see, again, it comes back to what the purpose of having the mobile phones in the classroom. Technology and education technology has moved on significantly to the extent where the learning experience can be so immersive for students now. And there's so much data demand required for the use of technology effectively within the classroom environment. Are mobile phones going to be able to support the whole extent of that? And then you've got all the issues of different devices. You're talking Androids, iOS, etc. Again, that's another hurdle for an educator to come across or to come over when it comes to delivery, or, you know, a successful delivery. It's great. Perhaps, you know, accessing web and doing online quizzes, you know, taking a quick vote within the classroom, assessing where students are. It's great for tools like that. But that should be the norm. We should be thinking about more transformative ways of you know, radicalizing education. I'm not convinced that mobile phones has the capacity to do that. We need to start thinking about more powerful tools within the classroom.
Okay, so moving on to that, do you feel that AI is the future of education or not? And that's artificial intelligence. And can you explain why or why not?
Okay, well, you know, when we think about AI, whenever you think about artificial intelligence, you know, I'm starting to think about Will Smith's, you know, iRobot movie. I can't remember what it was now, but you're talking about robots that have human senses and human sensory. You know, we've got to bring it back down a little bit. So let's look at where AI in industry or generally within the world is working pretty well, and that's seamless and invisible, and we don't even realize it. So, you know, we're sat in our front room, we turn on the television, we're watching Netflix, and there's already recommendations of things that we should watch based on the trends and based on what we've been researching. When you go on the internet and you go in shopping and etc., and the advertisements that you see on your screens are based on your interests, and, you know, these are subtle artificial intelligent tools. Now, let's just pick that up and put that into an educational context. Can you imagine an environment where a student is accessing certain learning content, and because the artificial intelligence and the data behind it, and the big data perhaps that's been used behind it, streamlines the process that that child is now going to experience based on what their needs are? So they may find that based on data levels, we're going to go down this pathway, and the questions that are set or the curriculum path going forward is more personalized to you. That removes potentially the need for humans to dictate what pathways students should take. So there is a future for it, but there needs to be a significant investment in ensuring the outcomes that the AI or that the technology is giving is actually appropriate for what the student is. And I think that's where the data comes in the back end.
Smile.
Yeah,
can you hear me? I've heard you. We just had a bit of a tech problem there.
Okay.
With regards to big data that you've just mentioned, can you just explain it clearly for those listeners who don't know anything about big data? Is it influencing the education sector? Is it hype? And are there any limitations to it?
Education has always used data to support the decisions that they make. So I think education and schools are very much data driven. Teachers' jobs are always endlessly analyzing data and inputting data. And the curriculum and the way forward is decided based on what the input of that data is. And there's usually somebody sat on another end of the screen who makes particular decisions on the curriculum and the things that we can offer and the data that's been provided previously. I think what big data is doing now is providing a more of a enhanced analysis opportunity, where the data is streamlined and all the data is put together to reduce the, the human element of making the decisions and having a structure in place which allows you to make more informed decisions. So I'm going to give you some examples of where big data has been used. It's very new to lower school levels, and it's very new to UK as well. But in some instances, and these are extreme instances I'm just referring to, is lecture theatres where at university levels, where all the data up until the educational point is used to help students decide on what type of courses that they should go on. So how have we been doing it at the moment? You know, a student takes an online quiz on a careers website, and based on what they answer, they suggest certain career choices on a 5-minute quiz. Imagine having all the data backed up at the back end. So looking at nursery schooling, cognitive tests, looking at CAT tests, looking at all the data on assessments, all the way up, and all that is crunched to provide a bit more of a personalized experience for that student, and suggestions on careers and courses and pathways, and something that they'd be successful in. So it's about that. And when I was referring to the extreme cases, I've read up on cases where, you know, there are cameras which detect the students' responses within the classroom, the facial expressions. You know, there's digital devices that are around the wrist of students which can monitor the heart rate. Can you imagine this now? This is going into Big Brother territory now. And all that data is fed back to the teacher to analyse and give suggestions on, well, this student was very engaged in this particular aspect because, you know, this is what the facial expressions and the heart rate and everything suggested, and they were really engaged. So it gives, you know, more power to the teacher. I'm not convinced, you know, that that's the way forward within education at the UK, especially lower levels. I can imagine a big uproar in terms of safeguarding, etc. But I suppose there is a future, but it's interesting to see what data can be used and how it's put together.
I mean, that moves us nicely on to educational technology trends that are coming up. And I'm glad that you mentioned that, because some of the things that I've been researching are things like having biometrics in schools, so monitoring attendance and borrowing books. And there was an interesting bit, and I do think it is a big brother, but it was basically talking about eye tracking methods to monitor what's being taught or absorbing learning. So we would, as teachers, be able to see what students have absorbed based on what we're delivering. And that comes from the advertising, that literally comes from the advertising sector, where they did some research about how consumers respond to adverts, and we could actually replicate that in the classroom and with teaching. So in terms of technological innovations, just to finish off, how do you see things moving forward within education?
I remember 10 years ago, we were having discussions about, you know, can you imagine having a camera in the classroom and recording what you're doing? And, oh my God, that would be horrendous. And lo and behold, 10 years later, we've got things like, you know, an iPad sat at the back of the classroom for actually following me around the room while I'm teaching, so that they can check the framing of my questioning and I can look back on it. And it's actually proved to be a really, really powerful tool. For me, the trends going forward within education and technology is more to do with immersive and virtual reality technology to help the students in terms of really engaging and allowing them to encapsulate the learning environment a lot more. And I think that's what's the next big thing, in my personal opinion, that will have a significant impact. We've already seen things like Google Classroom, Google Environment, where, you know, you've got the goggles on, you can actually immerse yourself within certain learning. Can you imagine that within different subject areas and specific fields?
Yeah, I mean, I guess
where students can really immerse.
I mean, I went to an EdTech exhibition, and this is a shout out to John Neal. It was part of the EdTech Summit, which was delivered by Apps Events. And they were actually showing exactly VR, AR, different technologies that we can use. And Google did come out on top with experiential learning using VR.
Yeah.
And for those of you who don't know, VR is virtual reality. So for example, in a classroom, if you're teaching science, you could actually do an experiment that is risky, but without actually doing it practically, you could use it in a VR environment. So that can really transform teaching and learning, can't it?
Absolutely. Can you imagine in a science classroom, you put your goggles on and you're standing on the moon?
Yeah.
And this is exactly what it is. And, you know, this is first-hand real-life experiences and procedures and processes that you really need to get into the nitty-gritty of for those learners that need to practically see it and visualize it to understand it. It immediately enhances that particular process. And it really helps them. And the engagement factors and the engagement levels are significantly going through the roof with them particular environments. So, and it's something that can be used across the piece in all subject disciplines. Let's not forget, and this is my key message as well, you know, when we're talking about technology in education, take your ICT subject teacher hat off, take your computer science subject teacher hat off. Let's start thinking broader. And that was one of the biggest learning curves that I had working as a whole school, is the reason for a little bit of resistance along on the other side of the curriculum is because they see it as, well, it's computer science thing, ICT. Well, it's, you know, how do we bring it into PE? How do I bring it into drama? How do I bring it into other disciplines? And you must put that hat on. And the only way that's going to happen is you have these experts within those fields actually come on board.
And some of the other technological trends that I was looking at was obviously artificial intelligence, which we've already discussed. But the whole point of it is to make sure marking, grading, assessments and feedback is much easier for teachers. Yes. And you mentioned personalised learning, also personalised learning for students with special educational needs. And also having AI tutors to teach maths and writing would make things simplify things as well. Other technological trends are cloud computing, moving everything online, so the possibility of having no more books. But like you said earlier, you don't think that's completely the right way to go, but students would be able to chat live with teachers. I was really interested in the 3D printing, which I haven't seen in schools yet, but 3D printing is basically where, let's just suppose you were teaching again science and you were showing them molecules, you could actually print out a 3D version of a molecular structure of water, for example. So you've got two hydrogens and an oxygen, and that's in a 3D shape. That would make complex things much simpler for teaching and learning. We discussed social media, whether it's a good idea to have it in classrooms or not. Virtual field trips, which are already happening. And, you know, there's some things that haven't haven't come into education like I thought they would. So, for example, like multi-touch services for live collaboration, there was a project that Durham University did many years ago, but I haven't seen it in schools yet. And obviously game-based learning through the teaching of video games and things like that, and the learning analytics. So finding out what types of info students enjoy most, whether they enjoy learning video, text or images, and whether things have been effectively delivered or not. So there's a lot there in technology that we can look forward to, providing that it's implemented in a strategic way.
Absolutely right. And it's, you know, ultimately it's an enhancement tool. It's got to be looked at as an enhancement tool, but it's got to be, if it's used well, and that's the same with anything, any aspect of life, and where you'll see significant benefits and gains.
Ismail, I'm sure we'll be talking more about this because there's so much in tech that we can discuss. It's been absolutely fantastic, and I'm so pleased you came in today. Where can listeners get more information if they'd like to get in contact with you?
If they can, you know, the more than welcome. You can Google me, or just type in Isidan, or if you go onto LinkedIn, search for me on there. And you're more than welcome to contact me on there as well. You can follow me on Twitter as well. I'm active on there.
Would you be able to put your Twitter handle into the chat box so that people can get that information?
Absolutely fine, no problem.
Great. Tech geeks are seriously cool. I spent most of my time with them, so it's been really interesting talking about tech today and the issues within schools and how it actually can be a good thing as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Brilliant. Next up, he's back. We can't keep him away. Stay tuned.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News with Sebastian Sagnier.
I am Sebastian Sagnier, and this is Teachers Talk Radio with the news. The First Lady Jill Biden will be welcoming students across America to the nation's capital in a virtual trip to Washington, D.C. It is the latest virtual trip produced by Discovery Education, a global edtech leader. The Shadow's Child Poverty Minister, Wes Streeting, has warned that the government will face the impact of what he called recent grotesque school budget cuts. He also revealed he is undergoing treatment for kidney cancer. The popular Netflix show, Sex Education, is rumoured to be aired this June or July. This comes at a time of much discussion over the government's new RSE curriculum that is now compulsory for all schools. This is Teachers Talk Radio, and that was the news with me, Sebastian Sagnier.
Thanks, Sebastian. Dr. David Boyce is a cosmologist, physicist, mathematician, and space nut. He's been on the show before. He wanted to come back. We're pleased to have him back. Welcome back, David. How are you?
I am very well, thank you very much. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. We're going to be talking about boarding schools. David's going to be coming back regularly. He's going to be taking part in science experiments. He's going to be talking about teaching and learning with regards to science. But today we're going to focus on boarding schools in particular. So, David, what's a boarding school?
Well, you'd be surprised that it is just like a normal school for most of the time, that we do GCSEs and A-levels, we do it in classrooms. The kind of image that you might have in your head of something like Harry Potter's The Hogwarts Express isn't quite right. It's just like a normal school. But where it is different is in the way that we look after the children after the school day has finished. So our main difference is the fact that we kind of offer this wraparound 24-hour care. And so in that effect, the staff here act as parents during term time to these pupils.
And so what's it like working there?
Well, I've worked in lots of different settings. I've spent half of my career in the state sector. I've worked in an independent grammar school. And then this opportunity came up to work here in a boarding school. And, you know, I really didn't know what I was, what to expect, really, because it was very different from, the sort of, well, I'd never describe my career before as 9 to 5, because teaching is never 9 to 5. But here it is a case of you would act very much like a parent would act, like to you, towards your own children. And so you need to imagine that children have needs throughout the entire week, and at weekends too. And so as a teacher in a boarding school, I think that perhaps the biggest difference is that as a teacher, that you would be expected to be responsive to that need. And so what I find is that I'm doing all sorts of things. I'm, taking some boys out to McDonald's on a Sunday, or I'm going and supervising some cricket on a Saturday. And so basically it fills the whole week. It's not a case of you're at work or you're at home. It's a case of the two are kind of blended together. And you might find that there's a half hour here, a half hour there. And so working in one feels very, very different. And to some people, that might sound almost slightly intimidating, like where are the boundaries and how do you protect your time and things like this? But actually, you're supported by all of the other members of staff that are doing exactly the same thing. So those members of staff, we're all pointing in the same direction. We want it to be amazing for the children. That's what we're after. That's all that we care about, is just making sure the experience is good for the children. And so what we find is that, you know, we're all in it together, we're all pulling forward, and it actually is very, very enjoyable. We have quite a long school day. So our school day starts at just after 8 o'clock. And on most days, lessons continue until about 5 o'clock. So we fit quite a lot in the school day. We also have lessons on a Saturday morning, and then sport on a Saturday afternoon. And then there are occasional duties on a Sunday as well. And we do basically say to new recruits that a school like this would be a 7-day-a-week boarding school. And that's just to be realistic about the expectation that there will be that expectation to do extra. But I've worked it out, and it works out that for all of this extra work you might feel like you're doing, I think you're actually doing probably the same hours as I would have done in my previous jobs. And this is because the term times are shorter, but we try to cram more in to them during term time. So from that point of view, it sounds a bit strange, but actually it works out about the same.
Yeah, so I've had a couple of listeners messaging Tim. Tim says it sounds really busy, and Khalil says it's full on is an understatement, which I would agree with. It sounds like you're constantly working in a boarding school. So what type of students do you get, and why do you think parents choose boarding schools?
Well, that's a very good question. We get a massive variety of pupils, and it wouldn't really be fair to typeset one particular type. And the pupils from a diverse range of backgrounds. And there is a common misconception that boarding schools are kind of elite or for whatever. But we have an awful lot of pupils that are supported by bursary. And so pupils can access the things that we're doing here just by basically contacting us and getting in touch. From my point of view as a physics teacher, I understand that there are not that many physics teachers out there. And so, you know, if you really have a massive desire to do physics and you're good at physics, but there is no provision where you are, then that's the sort of time to pick up the phone and give us a call and see what options are available. But generally, the whole what sort of pupils are we providing a service? Well, I kind of look at it like this. Now, I believe in globalization. I believe that the sort of future of the world is that there are there's big business going on, there's commerce going on, and what that asks of people is to break out of that kind of mold of being 9 to 5 and working very locally. What it asks of big business is that people will work internationally all over the world at strange hours. And one thing we do have to consider is, what about the children? You know, we shouldn't make the world so that to have successful economies requires us to have children that don't, for whatever reason, are you know, somehow not allowed to be there. You know, that, how do they fit into the picture? Well, what this can offer is to business people is that we will provide that stable, nurturing environment with all the childhood experiences that you would expect, so that big business can carry on, and so that you know, people all over the world, and this is not just a UK thing, there are international schools and boarding schools all over the world that actually provide this wraparound care for those people that actually need it. They need it for their day jobs, and they need it for their for the businesses they run.
So can I just clarify, do you live on site, and do the students live on site, and what's that like? What's the accommodation like?
Right, well, I live in a school house, and that's just a school property, like a normal house. But what we do have in the town is that we have 15 really large boarding houses, and they're, each boarding house is all boys or all girls, so it's single sex. And in each house, there's about 70 or so pupils. Now, I think the best way to think about it is, if you remember your university days, now just imagine a kind of age-appropriate version of that with halls of residence. Lots of people in a house, big central dining room, all looked after by a house parent, like a house mistress or a house master, a tutor team of teachers that just, they're within the school normally, and they are just teachers, and they come and support the house. They spend a night a week talking to their tutor group, and doing activities with the house like that. Now, they're scattered all over. They tend to be big houses. Imagine a house that can comfortably take 60 to 70 children. They're great big houses, and they're scattered all around. So at certain times of day, you see a whole herd of children walking down the street, and then another time of day, they're all walking back again, and you get quite used to the rhythms of everything here. But some boarding schools are different. They have a boarding much more centrally, like very close to their buildings within an enclosed campus. In this particular situation, we're spread over the whole town, and that's common to quite, you know, a number of boarding schools. And we have a very nice environment, and this is, you know, where I am based is it's a market town in a very rural area of the United Kingdom. So it's a very sort of safe place. Children can walk around unaccompanied, and, you know, there's no great fear of crime or anything like that. And it's actually a nice environment where they, you know, where they can be themselves, and with the company of all of their friends and everything, they can grow up, and it's just a nice sort of safe place.
We've got a listener who's messaged in. Tim says that he's a resident tutor as well, and he says you definitely have to live here, and he's only had one full day off in May today, and he never hardly gets any time off. So it is quite a demanding thing working in a boarding school. What's the curriculum like?
Well, in terms of the curriculum, I mean, I'm a kind of an academic subject teacher. So like physics, it looks exactly the same. It's the same physics that I've taught in every other school. There's no difference in that. I do have a really nice swish new build lab to work in, which I'm so lucky. It's just it's a wonderful sort of environment. And but actually what actually happens within that, it is very much the same. So it's the same physics, and it's the same GCSEs and A-levels that everyone else would have to take. One of the interesting things about how our curriculum might work is not how it's different, but how we kind of fit it in. In my previous schools, we found that you're trying to fit an awful lot into a very small amount of time. And so the density is very, very high, and it doesn't leave much time for exploration, for thinking about it. It's go, 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 go. How can we get as much information into these people in the shortest amount of time possible? However, here, we've kind of got almost an excess of time. We're here kind of all the time. And with that time, we can then go and explore other things. We can kind of go off syllabus a little bit. We can, you know, do a little bit of astronomy here, or have a look at particle physics over there. And so from that point of view, it's almost exactly the same. Where we differ is with the time, and that's one of the I think the greatest things that I would advocate in this system is the amount of time that people get for things like music and sport and personal development and social development. They're in some of my previous schools, the access to grown-ups basically ended at the end of the school day. And so the pupils would come to school, they'd be at school, and then they'd go home again. And then that was it. There was no more development that could occur using the like facilities of the school or the interaction with friends or those sorts of things once they'd all gone home. But here they stay with us that little bit longer, and it's their physics teacher and their maths teacher that's taking them to archery or I don't know what, something. And that contact builds a really good relationship between the pupils and the staff that actually then extends back into the lesson.
So clearly they have more enrichment opportunities because they have more access to the teachers.
That's right, yeah. And the enrichment is a really important part of what we do. But we do the same sorts of enrichment that you would see in any school. So Duke of Edinburgh Award, things like that. We've got a CCF, a Combined Cadet Force, which is really popular. They march up and down in their Army, Navy and RAF uniforms and go on camps and things like that. But then there's also lots of other things that are smaller under the radar, such as doing all sorts of things. Like there's a group of our youngsters that basically go around cleaning park benches and actually volunteering and helping the local community. And the local community are very, very gracious because they support us and everything that we do. And we want to make sure that it's a two-way stream, that we're going around, we're helping the town, not trying to be a burden or anything. And so there's all sorts of extra things that you could do. There's lots of time in which to do it. So from my point of view, I mean, my interests are in mountain climbing and rock climbing and things like this. And it's actually brilliant from my point of view as a teacher, because normally I would have to put aside my work to do the thing that I really loved, you know, but now it's become a part of my work. And so I can go rock climbing as a part of my job. And that is like, yes, you know, why didn't I think of this earlier, you know?
And so why did you choose to work in a boarding school? Because I know that your background, you've worked across a different range of schools, but why particularly boarding schools?
Well, it's a mixture of things, really. I think it was the right opportunity in the right place at the right time. But more than that, I do think that boarding schools have come an awful long way. And from my, I didn't even, I think when I started teaching, realize that boarding schools were still a thing or that they still existed. I was kind of familiar with the whole Harry Potter thing. And my preconceptions were quite wrong, actually. When I actually got here and I saw it, I realized that what is being provided for is something that actually fits with the modern world. It's very future focused. This whole idea that we can professionally look after children outside of their lessons to enable, you know, big business and commerce, and to also to provide something that speaks of a time gone by whilst also being future facing. I've just realized that this is it's unique, it's different, but it's actually it's providing a vital service. So I saw that and I thought, you know, that's for me. I'm going to do this.
And so, David, you're very active on social media. You do lots of experiments related to physics and the other sciences. Can you just explain to our listeners what they can look forward to when you come back onto the shows in the future?
Well, I'm really keen on science. I see that part of the job description of a scientist, whether or not they're working at a university, in a school or anything like that, is communicating the science to anybody that will listen, basically, in any way. So on Twitter, I'm always talking about this or that. On this show, yeah, I think it's a case of trying to answer life's biggest mysteries, like Why do you get a ring on the table when you put your cup of tea down? And why does having a cup and saucer solve the problem? You know, these are the most like important things that we need to get past as a society. We need to understand the basics. And also there's just stuff you see every day. The most amazing thing about science is that it gives you an understanding of how everything seems to fit together and how everything is actually a part of this one great big explanation. And the small things that you observe and think, huh, that's strange. Actually, there is stuff behind it that can help us understand. And so that's what I hope to bring, a little bit of lighthearted, but at the same time, interesting science of the everyday.
Great. I look forward to it. I've had a couple of listeners message in. Navida says, you don't often hear such a positive side to boarding schools. She's not a fan of them, but she says that you've given a different insight to it today in terms of enrichment and school hours and having longer access to teachers. So thank you for the enlightenment. She also says, how much time do you get off? It seems like you're on duty 24/7. So when do you get your me time?
It's a good question. We get longer holidays, and that I remember when I first got into teaching, there was a non-uniform day, and one of the oldest teachers there, this was in a state school, he had a t-shirt and he says the three best things about teaching were Christmas, Easter and the summer. And that made me laugh, that there is a significant payback in that time that you get. But I think it's just a case of, I think you have to ask yourself, and I've seen this, there seems to be like, and I'm polarizing here, but teachers that when they're teaching, they are like an actor, and it takes a huge amount of effort to maintain that thing. And so for that person, their time off is vital for them to almost recover from the performance of teaching. But what I try to do is just to be myself, and I'm unfortunately excessively myself, and that's one of the things that it doesn't feel like a performance. I'm just being myself. I'm talking about what I love. You know, I'm working with young people, and they're full of energy, and they give you loads of a load back from what you're putting in. So you know, it's important to snatch a few moments here and there, but. You know, I don't feel like I need a massive block of time. I just occasionally need just the tempo to be lower. And I think that's the exchange, that for me as a teacher, I'm fitting what I'm doing normally just into a larger amount of time. Tempo's lower. And I get those big breaks at the holiday times.
Thank you, David. Leanne's just messaged in saying she's exactly the same, especially with her year sixes. And she also said she just wants to have fun with the kids. And another caller said, your passion for teaching and physics is amazing, which I guess is what every parent wants for their child, right?
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, I always reflect on the difference between when I'm writing reports about the pupils and because I dislike doing it so much. I can't help but think, if you're at the bottom of the register, am I getting more and more negative as I go down? But then like the opposite of that is Parents' Evening. And I sit there sometimes, and Parents' Evening still makes me nervous. And I don't know, I've been teaching now for 13 years. I still get that prickle of, am I going to face a hostile crowd? And then when the people come on, they're overflowing with, you know, enthusiasm and like belief in what we're doing and what you're doing for their son. And one of the best things is that you can be a teacher that is absolutely marvelous, and you can, you know, in many ways 1,000 times better than me in every single thing. But what parents really, really value is when the child comes home and says, oh, you know, Dr. Boyce told us today that antimatter is going backwards in time. And they all sit around the table going, what even is this? But that kind of anecdote of Dr. Boyce said is brilliant. And then when you get on Parents' Evening, there's so much positivity coming back, because it's, you know, a huge part of teaching, other than the nuts and bolts of actually making people learn stuff, is inspiring them to find it interesting and to find it, you know, as interesting as I find it.
That sounds great. And I do think that passion for teaching does come across, and students and parents can pick up on it as well. So if that's not being communicated effectively, then that does make a difference to teaching and learning. Tim's messaged in saying that his non-resident teachers do one evening duty from 7 o'clock to 10 o'clock every fortnight. Sports on Saturdays are dependent on individual commitments. And as a resident in the boarding house, he does agree that three weekends a term and one he does three weekends a term and one evening a week, and it's a mixed boarding day with pupils there as well during the day and in the evening. And Leanne says that it's all about making it memorable, and I guess she's talking about teaching and learning. David, it's always a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for coming on to the show. I'm going to look forward to discussing science with you on the next time you come on. I don't know if I've told you before. When I was in year seven, I didn't have a very good science teacher and I used to get grade E's, David. I wasn't great at it. So I just naturally assumed that I was rubbish. But by the time I left in year 11, I got double A star. And then that convinced me to take A-levels. So I have got a biology and chemistry A-level, would you believe?
Wow. Well, this we're going to work on this, Sonia. we're going to do a bit of physics, I think, and just bring everything up a little bit.
Okay, great. Thanks, David. Okay.
Thank you so much.
So, have you entered our fabulous competition yet? Do you have something to say about the future of education? Do you have positive ideas about the way things could or should be in the future? You need to create a 10-minute video presentation and send it to teacherstalkradio@gmail.com. You can win £50 and it will be featured at a high-profile education event. The deadline is 22nd of May. It's just a week away. Don't miss it. It's a really good opportunity to get your ideas out there. It's been another amazing show today. My guests were wonderful. So thank you very much to Ismail Dan, and also David Boyce for coming back on. Please keep an eye out for Graham's show next. Then we have Khalil's Sunday show at lunchtime today. And of course, we have Tony this evening. Thanks for tuning in to another Stellar Sunday. You've been absolutely fabulous. Thanks for listening.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News. You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.